Do you want to talk about From Cliche to Archetype?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. Well, I read it. I read every word. So this book was written in 1970, so this was 6 years after Understanding Media.
There was a Life magazine article on McLuhan in 1966, and he lists this book in there. If you read his letters, he started this in the early 60s with Wilfred Watson. A lot of Understanding Media is his 50s thinking, and Cliché Archetype is his most advanced 60s thinking. It doesn't get out until 1970, but it represents a lot of mid-60s thinking.
Okay, so who was this poet, Wilfred Watson? What was Marshall McLuhan's relationship with him like, and why did they decide to work on this together?
Yeah, why did he make the team? Well, if you've heard me talk about Sheila Watson, who has the best PhD on Wyndham Lewis, ever heard me mention her?
Maybe, but nothing stuck, so.
Oh, okay, yeah,
no.
Before you start paying attention. It was a few months ago. When you stop just being in the flow.
Right.
Okay, so Sheila Watson married Wilfred Watson, I don't know, probably back in the 40s, and she was 3 years older than McLuhan. Watson was around McLuhan's age, or 3 years older than McLuhan, I have to look that up. And so they went to Paris in the 50s. They got their European clout. You had to be in Paris back then. That was the big hip place. Even Trudeau went there in the early 50s, late 40s. So they did Paris, and then she started studying Wyndham Lewis. So she came back, and she decided to become a student, and she registered under McLuhan. I don't know what level she was at, but eventually she starts doing her PhD under McLuhan, and he guides her for many years. It comes out in 1965. And many Wyndham Lewis professors nowadays said, if we had read that thesis, you know, 50 years ago in 65 when it came out, we would have been way ahead of our studies and understanding of Wyndham Lewis. So Sheila had the advantage of talking to McLuhan about Lewis.
And the advantage of brilliance.
Her own brilliance, yes.
Okay.
There is a biography written by a friend of Marsh McLuhan and of that scene in Toronto, Fred Flahiff. Anyways, in 1955, before she starts studying under McLuhan, her husband, Wilfred Watson, establishes himself as a poet in Canadian literary circles because T.S. Eliot praised his book of poetry came out in 1955, and therefore Wilfred Watson won the prestigious Governor's General Award in 1955-56. So he was the up-and-coming poet, but he also was a playwright. So he and Sheila end up teaching out in Edmonton in the early 60s, and they started a journal called The Pelican. But they know McLuhan is the real heavy poet of the era of Canada and the world. So they stay in touch with McLuhan, and Sheila becomes a very close friend of the family, and almost like a, quote, aunt, would babysit the kids when the McLuhans went away when she was in Toronto. So you have this correspondence between Wilfred Watson and McLuhan through the 60s. But when McLuhan went to Fordham University in 1967 for the Albert Schweitzer chair, he was away for a year. He left the coach house in the sort of control of the Watsons and another guy, Arthur Power, I think. But anyway, so the Watsons were subbing in doing the teaching. And I have an interview with Sheila Watson done in 68. She also used to write for Arts Canada on Lewis and art matters. She does this interview, and it's incredible how much she can spew the McLuhan stuff, the most advanced McLuhan stuff. Right in the beginning when Women's Lib is starting, and she's this very abstract person who is talking way beyond the feminists with this McLuhan stuff, and it's quite a tribute to her brain. She's now considered the founder of postmodern Canadian literature. In universities around the world, Canadian literature is very popular. These are Margaret Atwoods and other people, Michael Ondaatje, because Canadians live right beside the American elephant for the last 50 years, and so they have the media experience the rest of the world doesn't have, but they're not American, so they have a unique philosophical perspective. So they tend to make fiction that's interesting to people, cultures around the world who had to, more and more the last 30 years, put up with the American android meme, and they had to get a position in relation to American culture. So Sheila Watson, her book was pretty avant-garde, probably influenced by her studies of Finney's Wake and Wyndham Lewis. She's considered the mother of postmodern literature in Canadian literary history. So she has her own reputation. anyways. And then, but when they got teaching the year McLuhan was away in 67, 68, Wilfred Watson, probably trying to be a super artist like McLuhan, starts putting McLuhan down in the coach house. Now, I don't know how blatant that was. I just heard rumors of this. And so when McLuhan came back, there was a lot of tension between Wilfred Watson and McLuhan, yet they were, you know, slated to publish this book. They had a contract. So it got to the point where they wouldn't talk to each other. They would only meet with McLuhan's secretary, Mark Stewart, and sit in the room there, and Marshall would say something to Mrs. Stewart, and Stewart would pass it on to Wilfred, and Wilfred would pass it back to Marshall through Mark Stewart. So that's how absurd it is.
Kind of like you and me, Bob.
Yeah, like me and Carolyn. and who's the Mark Stewart? Whoever we're on the phone with. Whoever we're on the phone with. Yeah, so so they eventually had a rapprochement, where they met in a hotel, and they did their dialogues and recorded them, and it's the two of them apparently alone, and they agreed to talk, and it was in this hotel suite and, you know, on neutral ground. And that was recorded, and Wilfred Watson released some of those a few years ago, and they're pretty interesting. So in the end, most people, when Cliched Archetype came out, considered the book a disaster. They thought it was disjointed and this and that. And they didn't know that there was this battle going on between Watson and McLuhan throughout the book. But that's if you have a superficial understanding of McLuhan. With my depth understanding, I find it not so disjointed. If you understand how Watson was personalizing what the Cliched Archetype process, and McLuhan was consistent with what he'd already said, it works out. So it's a great book, and final point in my little preamble here is, a few months ago, Ion showed his expertise on McLuhan. If you recall, no, you wouldn't, this is before you start paying attention, but you go back and hear it, maybe Bart will make a mashup out of it. What's interesting is Ion says, what about Marshall's autobiography? And I said, he never wrote a biography about himself or an autobiography. He wouldn't answer me, so I started probing. I said, understanding media, which we used to joke about, media, understanding why I die. Me die, mm-hmm. It could be a mystical meaning in there or a technical meaning. So I said, that could be a hidden autobiography. So I said, understanding media, he goes, correctly. He says, no. Then I mentioned some other book. He goes, no. And then I remembered, I've always personally said that Cliché Archetype is a very personal statement by McLuhan. I probably even said autobiographical. I at least would say it was about himself. So I suddenly remembered, oh yeah, Cliché Archetype. So I said, from Cliché Archetype, he says, yes, bingo. And I said, immediately said, now that is expert commentary, Ion. You're a graduate of McLuhanism. To know that it's an autobiographical. But that's for sophisticated post-grad perception. Let's go to what you read. And what you read was a challenge to archetype as defined by Carl Jung. Okay? Did you get that?
Okay.
That much? Did you?
Yeah, and I thought it would be helpful at the beginning to define some terms, like let's define cliche, let's define archetype, let's define probe, let's define retrieval.
Very good. So
I
will. I will go to, you can go to dupes also, because I have it right there, what I'm going to use. We just have to find it. Can you go to dupes while we're on here?
Yeah, I'm in there right now.
Oh, okay. So I get in there, and because I had to come another route, I've got to register just a second. All right, so I'm going to go to page 3 or so, where I start having excerpts from McLuhan, LaRouche, Thompson, and Croker. You remember that part? Let's see if we go down to the bottom of part 3. No, page 4. Okay, reading, resonant interval, McLuhan. Okay, so that's part 2, probably part 1. So you see on page 4 at the top, it has all these references to Croker, Thompson, McLuhan, which is all excerpts from my book, Phatic Communion, with Bob Dobbs. You see that?
No, where do I want? I'm at the very beginning.
Right. Are you on Board Index? Don't go up to View Unanswered Posts and View Active Topics. You go to Board Index.
Okay.
And then you click on the word ION. And then over on the right, it says 1 through 3. You click on 4 over in the far right above the posts, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay.
Then you scroll down, you see Coker, Coker, Thompson, McLuhan, McLuhan. So I'm looking for McLuhan Part A, which might be over on page 3. It might have been jumped forward. So you can go back to page 3. But you see the listing of writers, right?
Yeah, I do.
So those are excerpts from each one of them. So I got to find Part A, the McLuhan one, which has probably been commented on, so it's back in page 2. Or 1. Let's see, I'm scanning down through 2. Not there, so page 1. Where is it? Buddy, it's not there, Part A. Do you see Part A, McLuhan?
No. Writing I'm going to go back to page 4 and look there.
Yeah. Okay, anybody else who's on can listen to this. So there it is, at the top on page 4, Part A. So we go down to, I include McLuhan's tetrad on pattern recognition, or on archetype, or in cliche, we'll see. So I'm scanning down, so it looks like it's in B, McLuhan B, which we scroll down. McLuhan B, writing, reading, the resonant interval, McLuhan. There it is. So you see on page 4, you go down, it says part 2B, writing, reading, the resonant interval.
Yep, I see it.
Okay, so you
click on the flower people?
Yes, now two more down, it says instant replay. So he does a tetrad on the instant replay technology, which came in late 60s, early 70s. A, what does the instant replay enhance? It equals, instant replay of experience equals the cliche. Amplifies cognitive awareness. Wipes out, that's obsolescence, the merely representational chronological, you would call that visual space. Retrieves meaning, in the sense of I.A. Richards' famous book in the 20s called The Meaning of Meaning. He was a Cambridge professor, and then push to extreme, the instant replay flips from individual experience to pattern recognition, the nature of the archetype. Aha!
Okay.
Now we have archetype is a pattern. Pattern, recognized pattern, usually collective. People, it goes beyond an individual pattern, individual experience, into a pattern that the tribe agrees on, all right, or has remembered.
Okay. Right?
The role of the shaman is an archetype in those kind of early pre-literate cultures. And,
these terms came from printing technology to begin with. I think that's important to mention.
Yes, the word cliché is a...
They were the blocks
press.
Used to make the prints, and then the archetype was the original pattern.
That's right. Do they use the term archetype 500 years ago? I didn't know that.
Well, that was in the book, yeah. That was the original pattern, the first one from which all the other copies were made.
Okay, so what you have here, let me answer that this way. So you see the tetrad, and then you have a couple of statements where McLuhan uses the words archetype and cliché. So look what he says. The next sentence, that group of archetypalists who consider the linguistic form to be a recurring pattern of literary experience, that means generally speech and writing, describe what is antithetic or not clued into the cliche as probe. And the cliche to probe as probe is not limiting the archetype to written stuff. Gestures, media environments can become archetypal, starting off as cliche. So let's see the next sentence. A cliche is an act of consciousness. Total consciousness is the sum of all the cliches of all the media or technology we probe with, not just with speech or writing. You see?
Your environment can be cliche.
That's right. Environment.
Okay.
Whereas his competitor, Northrop Frye, the famous critic up at the University of Toronto, who established a big chunk of literary criticism authority in the 50s with his writing, he was a Jungian. He took archetype as images in poems, in literature, that was, you could say, stated by mouth or written. So he remained limited to the literary, the book experience, to find his linguistic, to find his archetype, which McLuhan calls the linguistic form of the archetype. What about all the post-language forms, the post-print media? So McLuhan's going to propose that cliches or imagery, which becomes pushed to archetypal levels, is in the later media environments. And that was quite controversial. Most people stay with the Jungian idea of archetype, or maybe some New Age kind of advance of that. They might say when they take drugs, they see archetypes in the collective unconscious. That's as far as they get. They don't see that the actual environments around us, the television, the radio, and the bulldozers and skyscrapers and all the things we make are archetypal, especially since 1957, say, the late 50s. When the abundance of the 60s started happening, you had many books made, you had many movies made, many TV shows, many laboratories, all the arts and sciences, much cultural production, right? So McLuhan
right.
said, "You'd since you had the repeating of the book form, the repeating of the TV form, all this repeating, they no longer were original new environments like TV was in the 40s and 50s. So you see an interview in the mid-70s, somebody asks him about the repeating of media. He says, oh, this happens many times over and over. And so all through the 20th century, a TV show, a movie, a book, a newspaper, a press conference, an election, all these things, so many have happened, they have become cliché. And then they become archetypal. They become so obvious that, so repeated and so cliché that actually they're subsumed by later environments that are repeated. So the older ones, like the book, becomes an archetype. See, so mm-hmm. When you want to be a writer, you want to be an archetype. But to be a YouTube blogger or to write for a TV show, that's a cliche. It's not archetypal status yet. You see what I'm saying? It hasn't been around long
mm-hmm.
enough.
Mm-hmm.
So then, let's see, what's next? Now, another interesting thing is McLuhan defines the cliche. Okay, now I say this. When a new technology comes in, it's the last word, that old slang word. This is the latest. It's the best. It's the last word on automobiles, you know, whatever the new car is. Then after a while, it becomes familiar, so it becomes a cliche. Now, 30 years later, they take the brand new car of the 1960s, which becomes cliche through the 70s and 80s, and in 1990 or 2000, Paul Allen or Bill Gates wants to have that car he cruised around when he was a teenager, so it becomes an archetype for him. So he goes looking for, you know, 1939 Studebaker wagon or something. So that is the art form phase. All right, people start collecting the cliché environments as art forms, and that would be the antique world, antique dealerships. I mean, that's what Deborah West does. She's in the art form phase of the automobile. She trades and sells, buys antique cars. Now, when, let's say, what would be archetypal, which is the fourth phase? So we've gone from last word, like, for example, Katie's talks to Bob about McLuhan are the last word over the last few weeks. Everybody loves them. Eventually, they're going to become cliche, and people get a little irritated. And we'll kick me or you out, and we won't be able to talk about McLuhan for a while. And then all of a sudden, someone will play on Ginny's show or Matthew's show an old recording from 2014 when Bob's talking to Katie about McLuhan, and long forgotten. But all of a sudden, it'll be fresh again. And everybody say, wow, we should get Katie and Bob back together again. That's a art form phase. And then I'll still be here, and maybe some of you will be still here, but in 1,000 years, the Katie Dobbs dialogues or never Katie dialogues will be considered archetypal and required experience. So there's the four phases, right? Now, here's what's interesting. When that's during the human scale reality, which was ended about 40 years ago. Once we started moving into the building of the digital android meme, tetrad management by the secret elites and the intelligence agencies switched to pentad management, which meant that the machines would run the show. Nobody could keep up with it. So just let the last word, cliche, art form, archetype process be recycled by the software programming, programming of the planet. And so this created great boredom for a lot of people over the last 20 years. But you can't stop the Android meme. Until recently, you couldn't stop. It has taken over the programming. So we call that artificial intelligence tetrad management, which is pentad management, where the machines have merged with the human. Okay, in that condition, stuff is turned over, flipped over so fast, the speed up, living, you know, 1,000 years every 12 months, then the process going from last word to cliche to art form to archetype is too slow. We now just go cliche and art form, archetype, cliche, archetype, cliche, archetype. And actually, an old archetype becomes new cliche. A new cliche becomes an old archetype. Now, here's what's interesting. That's where I got to that level. That's where my tiny note chart develops that. No time to retrieve anything. No time to obsolesce anything. And, that's not the way to say it. Everything is obsolesced, at least for the chemical body. But the Android meme is having a great time imitating the tetradic process, and so it's celebrating it and doing it the last 30 years. But it gets so carried away that it drops the extension and the flip. I guess it would be the flip part of the tetrad. Remember, the tetrad is enhance, obsolesce, retrieve, and flip into the opposite. So you're just going to end up with the phase two, obsolescing and retrieving. Now, you'll notice that is what Ion came up with a couple of years ago. Yeah, I never told him to say that. He started saying retrieving and obsolescing and retrieving, obsolescing and retrieving. He had caught up to my statement about the pentad management, which is just doing obsolescing and retrieving. Now, the book, From Cliche to Archetype, is pretty well that later developed speed-up process, obsolescing and retrieving. So cliche is the obsolesce, and archetype is the retrieve. Now, when a cliche is sitting there on the sidelines, obsolesced, eventually it will be part of the retrieval process. So Marshall said, if you look on the inside page, I don't know, if you got paperback or hardback of Cliche to Archetype?
I have hardback.
Okay, you've got the flap on the inside where it says ye old archetype equals new cliche. Do you see that?
Yeah, where it says new cliche writ large.
Yeah, read those,
yeah,
those words there.
New archetype is ye old cliche writ large.
Right. Any others? Is that it?
No, yeah, that's it. Then from cliche to archetype is Marshall McLuhan's most important and definitive statement on today's culture and technology.
Yes, okay.
Blah, blah.
And it is.
Mm-hmm.
He considered this book way beyond understanding media. Understanding media is just operating at the level of speech as an archetype. I found a note when I did his archives, organized them for his family. He said, understand media is based on speech as an archetype. Because by the time of the 50s, you've got these newer electric media, and the Gutenberg book has become at least an art form. That's what Ulysses by James Joyce. He turns a novel into an art form. So it's meta, meta, meta. Well, speech, the content of books, is way back there, been around a long time. So it's archetypal. Speech is archetypal. Books are art form. And electric media are extensions and new. Probably the movie has reached the obsolesce phase because it's before the simultaneous radio and TV experience. So you have here where understanding media is the speech is the archetype. So the content of writing of a book is speech. So speech is archetypal. So McLuhan is talking on the big picture level, big patterns, and people think that's what McLuhan believed in. That the medium was the message, and all that you read in Understanding Media, they thought that was Marshall's personal opinion. No, it was speech speaking through books and saying its view of things. So in other words, speech came alive and said, this is how you look at the world, and you read Understanding Media as if it was spoken by the archetype of speech. Now, that's pretty profound. You never heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's back 50, 60 years ago. Since then, with the turnover of electric media, by 1970, TV and early analog electric media, LPs, radio, are becoming cliche and moving towards archetypal status like speech. So the slower era of the 50s produced speech as an archetype. By the 70s and 80s, you've got the media environments as archetypal. So that's what this book is about, right? Understanding media is just speech as archetype. But cliche to archetype is the book speaking and allowing all the media to speak. And they are cliches becoming archetypes, and then obsolete archetypes retrieved as new cliche. So it's a cliche archetype, endless flipping and pushing forward. Now, McLuhan defined that as the essence of consciousness. What is the process of perception in normal human consciousness? It's the interplay between cliche and archetype. For example, you're sitting there and you're eating something, and then you get bored with that, so you go and turn on the radio, or you go do something else. So you drop one experience, which is new at the moment, and it becomes cliche, and then you start doing another sensory input, and then that becomes the new experience, and then it's cliche, and then it rapidly gets obsolesced by the later experience. You get in your car and drive somewheres. So each new experience, it's a cliche, because in the global theater, you keep repeating these things, but these cliches mime the process of consciousness, which goes from imbibing the moment, then the moment becomes cliche, and then you have a new moment, and then eventually you remember the previous moments. They come back as art form or just, say, archetype. So the turning over of perception done by the human chemical body is mimed by the interplay of all the technologies and their environments in the global theater, later subsumed into the digital android meme. So that's what he's trying to say here. Okay, this is what he tried to describe in this book.
Well, is it describing his life as an artist, though?
In particular, it's about how Marshall, by the late 60s, became a cliche, and then he would eventually become an archetype. And on the slower level, he's only been an archetype since Wired magazine made him their patron saint in 1993. But this is 20 years before, 1970. He's predicting he will become archetype. He already knows he's archetype, but nobody understands McLuhan that well, so they wouldn't give him that status. But he has become archetype in all the different meanings, including the Jungian meaning. He's talking about his own obsolescence and then retrieval of himself and new roles, including this book, Cliché to Archetype, is representing understanding media in a new way. He's taking the cliché media ecology of understanding media and replaying it as archetype disguised as new cliché. So the very process that he's going to do with his own analysis also describes his public image. You know, he has he's now become boring, because anybody becomes boring after a while in the global theater in the 60s and 70s, because everybody wants new, exciting, stimulating imagery. So there's been many, many artists, film directors, musicians that come and go. We know that. It gets your 15 minutes in fame, right? And Warhol got that statement from McLuhan, reading Mechanical Bride, probably, in the 50s. So, because Andy Warhol was in advertising in the 50s, and that book came out, the first one to really comment on advertising, so that's why Warhol, one of the top designers in Madison Avenue in the 50s, would notice this book, this strange new book, commenting on the new art form of advertising. So this process of being 15 minutes, famous for 15 minutes, is summarized by McLuhan as cliché archetype. But it's not only the cliché archetype of the content of the media, like people on Johnny Carson or TV shows or MASH, that's content. The forms themselves are going through the cliché archetype experience. So many people would watch TV to get the tactile massage to counter reading the newspaper or driving their car. The formal sensory dynamics of each media environment, which had their day for the 100 years before that, the 1850 to 1970, were now rapidly retrieved as a sensory massage. And that's why people would not really have any opinion about anything. They just whatever it and enjoyed the interplay of all their sensory extensions. And that's where for a young person gets born into that, a young chemical body gets born into that, and he sees his parents repeating their sensory massage of the archetypal forms, and it's boring to the kid. The kid gets agitated pretty quickly because the kid hasn't had the media turnover experience yet, and so it's going to go into its extreme rebellious, irritated, or screwed-up phase. Not just normal teen rebellion, which they say happens in all through history, the Oedipal thing. No, this is kids so alienated, they find that their parents are menacing, that the domestic arrangement is irritating. So they start getting into drugs and sex and rock and roll, whatever they can come up with. See? They cannot handle the global theater of cliched archetype flip-over retrievals and endless processing. They have no way to form identity in that situation. Which means to form identity would be to attach to a slower form of media and say, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a chartered accountant. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a laborer. I'm going to be a gigolo. I'm going to be, you know, these things that had roles for a while, for the several hundred years before that. You can't have just one role anymore. And the kid is trained in their education system to work towards some specialized role, and that's the huge disservice of the education system, teaching kids to get a degree in some specialized situation. So that, okay, so let's just look at a couple of these quotes again. In light of what I said, a cliché is an act of consciousness. Total consciousness is the sum of all the clichés of all the media or technologies we probe with. In other words, your consciousness is not made up of what you look and see. It's the environment you're using, how much you're using books, cars, automobiles, television, satellites. All these media are part of your consciousness now. It's not limited to the chemical brain, you know what I mean, your chemical body, skull. And then he says the next sentence, consciousness is not a verbal process. See, he's trying to show that consciousness involves the wearing, like clothing, of newer environments, which by the 70s become cliches, retrieved as archetypes. Then he says, today the multimedia have, as noted, demobilized consciousness. We speak of a lie as credibility gap. We can't say a lie is a lie. That's back in the Gutenberg literary simpler days where you either wrote it right or you wrote it wrong, and you said it right or you said it wrong. But since lying is not so offensive, verbal lying, since it's an obsolete medium, speeches, it just becomes a credibility gap. And then truth once again becomes trust, not Cartesian or print era certainty. Now notice that CA, that means cliched archetype, page 34. The one above it, understanding media, UM, page 87. The cliché is an act of consciousness, page 150. Now, let's see. The next quote, the tragic flaw, which is a phrase from Aristotle, is not a detail of characterization. It's not about your psychology and you're got some little flaw, you've got a little sin or a little vice. Not a mere fly in the ointment, but a structural feature of ordinary consciousness. In other words, your tragic flaw becomes the fact that you are an automobilist and you love cars and you work in the car industry. And you don't like these hoity-toity intellectuals like Katie who goes to theater or reads a book. In other words, the car person is dedicated to the car medium and doesn't like the print medium. All right? So if you're not aware that you have, that the clothing, the media you wear is biased, is a limitation. It's very hard for people in the last 50 years to notice the limitation of media because they enjoy them so much. They don't see them as a bias. It's only when you start up to talking in management position like Obama, you got to know the different media dynamics because you're talking to the whole world. So when you don't know that the media you use is your bias, that is the structural feature of a tragic flaw in ordinary consciousness. You see? So it's not your...
I do.
That's why people became amoral and all kinds of ethical revolutions, just people living very selfishly. They were still thinking their chemical body and particular chemical body limited actions, which used to have ethical qualities or not. Now the chemical body is so obsolete, and you're wallowing around in all these media environments, which are shrinking, you can't project chemical value systems, the old cultural value systems, on a multi-bodied situation. So, as someone said, here is this, someone sent me this ad, I think we talked about it last week, somebody on Craigslist or somewhere saying, has a picture of their nude torso, some woman says, I'm in the middle of tests, you know, university exams, I need a break, I have a relationship, but I'm willing to hook up with anybody, Eddie, for 10 minutes for a quickie. Okay, so their chip body enables them to have an affair, a quickie, and they don't relate it to their relationship in their chemical body. There's no, like, she might keep it secret, but it's not a binding ethical problem for them. See? So this multiple use of environments, which became bodies, If you're not aware of, let's say her lover catches her, if she doesn't, she doesn't have the model of explaining the multiple bodies, and then use that against him, because he's probably doing some multi-body stuff too in some way. So you have to know the four or five body model if you even want to engage in any ethical challenge or definition or morality. McLuhan just summed it up by saying 50 years ago, you cannot have ethics or morals in the discarnate electrified environment. And that's why, you know, the Kissingers and that, the conspiracy sites look at these terrible Trilateral Commission guys as causing wars and banking and inflation and collapsing and manipulation. They project on these chemical bodies of these elites, and they look like demons. They look like terrible, evil people. Well, you shouldn't project on Kissinger. He doesn't. He's not made up of just a chemical body. He represents the TV landscape in the White House for Nixon. He represented massive media environments that engage with other cultures. So you see, to accuse your normal, what do you call, bête noirs, the most of media is talking about how evil politicians are. All the TV shows are about that. That's a naive fairy tale unappreciation of the fact we live in a turnover of cliche archetype, endless retrieving and obsolescing. That's where this book comes into understanding the present. So you come to the next quote under the tragic flaw, which is not a detail of characterization of your chemical body. That's a mere fly in the ointment. It's a structural feature of ordinary consciousness. So you will find when I was discussing with Hillary during the fest, Bob Fest, she had no understanding of the structural biases in her notions of heart and mind and consciousness. She was only talking about the chemical body and romanticizing it. So there was a tragic flaw in her discussion. But it's pretty hard to get that point across. Okay, so then the next quote, The Happening, which was an art form, a mixed media kind of theater in the early 60s, The Happening exploits not only the clash of one cliche against another, but also the much more effective interface of a cliche from one medium with cliches from other media. So, for example, you take Sarah, the artist here, she may be listening right now. When she makes a collage, she takes cliche images and puts them together. She doesn't take a cliche from, say, television, or even use the form of TV as a cliche, and collage that with the form of movies or of one of the bodies. Usually people in their collage interplay familiar chemical body images or the content, like a picture of Hitler collage with Katie being a Hitler because she took over payday and dominated the second hour. Right? She's a Hitler. But that is a cliche from – that's content cliche. Real collage is the mixing of media environments themselves. So how do you do that? You do what McLuhan did. He'd write books, but he'd also show up in movies, or he'd be a professor, a teacher of literature. He never specialized in one role. So the more you adopt – and Ion advocates this – the more you adopt many different roles and are familiar with them – because if you explored them, you're collaging cliches of media, not the content of media. So, since we start off with the instant replay, here's a great quote that McLuhan wrote later talking about these issues. He says, see, by the mid-70s, you've got people engaging in pattern recognition constantly. In the pop culture, it was, you wouldn't watch a movie, you'd read a review. More and more people read reviews of the boomer generation to understand or to figure out their level of consumption. And that's because it wasn't time to see every movie or hear every song or album. So they would read a quick summary in a review, and that would be a way of grabbing pattern recognition about what was going on in the audience, in the global theater, or what was happening in your city. So, pattern recognition took over as a cliche fast production. So here's what McLuhan says about that by the mid-70s. One of the conflicts of a progressive and rapidly changing world concerns the use of surrounding services, or we could put in cliche, which have been obsolesced by daily innovations and discoveries. A vast new industry has been born from this conflict, and its name is camp. Remember the fad of being campy. And its motto is, quote, throw something lovely away today, help beautify junkyards. See, the whole planet by 1970 is a junkyard, and all the media environments are junkyards. you didn't really get a change happening until the digital world came in, and that was just changing the content of your computers. You still had a computer, and you still had television and TV and movies and that, but they were all around for so long, cliched and archetyped so many times, they were basically a junkyard. So you throw something lovely away today, you take an old cliche and retrieve it as new archetype, and that's how you beautify junkyards, the planet Polluto, P-O-L-L-U-T-O. So continuing the quote, despite the grotesque aspect of camp as the incessant revival of that which has scarcely had a chance to register its appearance or existence. In other words, things are getting so fast, turnover, that something almost didn't even make the obsolescence or camp phase. Now, Zappa talks to me and Carolyn about that in the 1988 interview. He talks about we're going to become a nostalgia for a moment we just had. He says the world will end in nostalgia. That's due to this speed-up, and that's what McLuhan's talking about here. The incessant revival, that which has scarcely had a chance to register its appearance or existence as an environment. It has already been self-obsolesced by the popular technology of the video replay. The instant replay, available many to the audiences of sporting events, offers, as it were, the meaning minus the experience. If you see the outcome and the replay before you have the process of natural unfolding of the experience, you have the meaning before the experience. He says that reverses T.S. Eliot's observation that, quote, we had the experience but missed the meaning. No, now we have the meaning and missed the experience. The instant replay is the meaning in that, let's see, the instant replay is the meaning in that it is less concerned with the input of experience than with the process of perception. What does the public think about what happened? So more and more experience becomes obsolete, another part of our boredom culture, and people want the meaning of what people are claiming to experience. And that's more and more why people would look to talk shows and commentate. They'd live by the talk show commentary or the Today Show commentary on what the meaning was of some reported minuscule experiences that a couple of people had. All right? So this replay indeed offers not just cognition but recognition and leads the mind to the world of pattern recognition, to aftersight and foresight. All right. Now, that's my little preamble. You take the mic and talk and relate or counter or whatever you want to say about it. I think I laid out a good pattern there for you, right?
You laid out a great pattern. And talking about the garbage, basically, I guess it's a good time to bring up the circus animals desertion poem that was such a big part.
All right, let me, I was going to bring that up. That poem by W.B. Yeats is about the obsolescence of his poetic inspiration. Did you get that?
Mm-hmm.
That he lays down, and he says, where am I going to find new inspiration? And this is written like 80 years ago, and his inspiration, shockingly, is found in the garbage dump, where he finds the
right, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart.
Right, and then you get Hillary in here argue over what the hell is the heart. But the heart is which old technologies you identify with. What ones did you like best? Like you eventually tried to become or are becoming a writer. That's your the technology closest to your heart. You know, that's what you want to be. So you don't want to be a TV producer at this point or this and that. You want to write. And, okay, so this poem, so McLuhan takes Yeats' poem and says he himself, having become a faker, an important figure and prophet in the global theater, has to lay down that old image of himself and find something new. But he didn't find it in a little garbage pile. He looked at the whole planet as a global dump, right? And he talked about the media environments as cliches and then retrieved as archetypes. That's the difference. He's on a broader level than Yeats' personal little dilemma. You see what I'm saying?
I do, and that's why I thought this book was partially about creativity. He also talks about the role of art providing an anti-environment through which we can reveal the invisible environments that we're in. So I think looking at all these cliché to archetype and how it flips back and forth is a way to see that water that we're swimming in, I guess.
Yes, let me say this. You brought up a very important point about creativity, because Marshall says, it's probably in one of these quotes later on down the way in this Dupes post, Creativity is the biggest stereotype of the 20th century. Now, you have kids, when they go to school, if they're still the same, this is the way it's been for 30, 40 years, they encourage the kids, ideally, to be creative, to be individual. At least in America, they do that. And, of course, it's all lost and killed by the environments, and the teachers don't know what they're talking about. But it's an ideal. Remember, one of the titles in the index, if you look at the table of contents, is the culture hero. What is it? The artist as culture, the culture hero, the identity of the artist. What's that chapter?
Just
look on the back of the book.
Author as cliche.
Look at the one. Look it down under I, identity. The culture hero.
Identity, the culture hero, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in the West, with individualistic Gutenberg arts and sciences having been produced for several hundred years, the archetype becomes the artist or the scientist. It's almost the pagan religion, and it's the culture hero. So McLuhan knows that creativity made by the chemical body and a few early techno environments are puny compared to the creativity of advertising, which is a global marketing and much billions of dollars go into make an ad, which is going to go and try to be a significant pattern when people see it. So the older arts become archetypal, see, the identity, cultural hero as a means of cultural identity. So that's why I have, you know, documentaries on Picasso or Stravinsky or all these, or hockey players even. Later, it gets into sports in the kinetic 80s and 90s. The culture hero is a nostalgia. And then they always, as my foster daughter says at the end of Who's Forgotten Fairyland, I owe it all to Bob, and most important, I believed in myself. Okay? So there's the cliche statement about your own inspiration. Now, so creativity on an individual basis is obsolete. And Marshall's saying, McLuhan is pointing out that we now know how young people or anybody becomes creative. We know that, he says in the Playboy interview, the identity of the creative process and the stages of apprehension, which I have on my tiny note chart. But we now can see not only the creation of identity, we can watch how the manager of society create cognition and create a global situation where the art forms are not little books or little movies or these content media. It is the interplay of the forms themselves. So here is W.B. Yeats talking about his creative process. How is he going to write another great poem? And he's exhausted, and his old tricks don't work anymore. So he starts just scrounging around with a kind of humility in the rag and bone shop of the heart in the garbage dump. I used to see Garrett Dean often used to look at garbage all the time and check it out. Dave Worster did that too. So that is personal creativity with the chemical body. But the environments right now, and it's been going on for 30 years, is the artificial intelligence managing huge environments and making sure that the economy doesn't go nuts in the middle of it as people panic within their own cultural context, like the Arabs panic when the American environment dumped on them, the French panic. You have all this global terrorism happening all over the place by everybody. That's all a huge identity crisis. So how does one be creative within that? How does the culture be creative? So McLuhan is expanding the creative process from the conventional level of being an artist or a scientist or being conventionally creative, which is what you have to be supposedly in any job you get. A reasonably middle-class job is they tell you, you got to be creative. We want you to input in our company. You know what I mean? These are normal values that they didn't say that 100 years ago. You had to keep your nose to the grindstone, not even talk, didn't even have a coffee break or anything. But as the software environment, more of a, quote, leisure society took over, then people had time to notice other things. And then management by the 80s realized, well, our workers are actually like us, they all engage in this new electric environment, and they're getting ideas that we don't have, so let's have dialogue. So brainstorming took over. So that's normal. The values of creativity, of traditional Gutenberg creativity, are normal in society. But it is not handling the disservices of a global inability to understand the collective creativity that's going on, which brings in paramedia ecology. So you see the shift I'm making to a larger level, and that's what McLuhan's addressing?
Mm-hmm. So, and that's because the whole world is basically a repertory theater, correct?
Right.
So these things
yes.
just keep playing themselves over and over again. So if you know that, then...
No, no, wait. Here, I would add this. I would see, I already kind of know where you were thinking of going, so I'll cut off the pass and add another level. It's not repeating for us anymore. It's the android meme repeating it for itself. The chemical body perceptor is not even engaged. I mean, if you want to be a writer, let's say you write a really fantastic, unique, rebellious book as charisma for the individualist streak in Westerners. What do? You, by your contract, got to go out and go and do your lecture circuit in Barnes & Noble and go around selling books and show up and answer stupid questions of the readers. You cannot be a radical if you have to, by your contract, go and speak to all kinds of cultures across the country. Carol likes to point out that a 9-1-1, that was the day her book was supposed to come out. Right, Carol? And so they canceled her book tour. But she was getting ready to do a very irritating book tour. So your chemical body is controlled way beyond any of the ideals that Shelley, Keats, and the Romantic poets and Byron had, which you will see discussed in the chapter Da Vinci to Holmes in The Mechanical Bride. That's the importance
of
this chapter.
Which I did go ahead and read. I did go ahead and read that chapter.
Yeah, we can go into that.
Mechanical Bride.
Because that is the archetype of individual creativity. Mm-hmm. The person who is not in the hoi polloi. He's not mixed into the mass consciousness. He's not stuck in the tribe. He's outside. He's wise. He can see the patterns of the society. He's a detective. And that becomes the archetype, beginning mm-hmm. with Da Vinci and then leading to Sherlock Holmes. That's the meaning of that chapter, is that the scientist and the artist for 150 years was doing the same process as the detective, which was a new form invented by Edgar Allan Poe, the detective fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that those three or four pages in the middle of A Mechanical Bride are really important to understand the archetype of creativity, hoiking up the individual Western man who's not part of the oral tribe. He's eyeball. He's detached. He's very observant. This is what Sherlock Holmes did. That is a visually, that's a visual space Gutenberg archetype, which becomes increasingly obsolete in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s in detective shows. Because you can't be detached and be a detective anymore by the 60s and 70s. So McLuhan had himself photographed in a Sherlock Holmes, you know, wardrobe, the stupid bird watching hat and the pipe and the little cape. You know, he put it on. But he was not being a chemical body detective. He was being a information detective. In other words, when you know how to look at the patterns, you can see the formulas of all kinds of press conferences and public relations gimmicks immediately. So his books were his form of detection. So it's a detective novel when you read Cliched Archetype. He's exposing the crime. And you'll find mm-hmm. out that crime has a whole interesting section in there. There's literate crime. There's oral society crimes. They're different. One of the cliches that's around now is that oral cultures are shame cultures. You lose face.
Mm-hmm.
But literate cultures have guilt, right? See, so there's different
mm-hmm.
dynamics just in that and what you would be as a criminal. So so we're saying that, see, you're saying the right quotes. Very important to name the Yeats poem because that's a major theme. But when you read the dialogues between Watson and McLuhan, Watson is an artist, a functioning Canadian grant-grabbing theater playwright guy up in Edmonton and wherever else, British Columbia, Vancouver, gets his plays down in the 1670s. He is showing the clash of media, but he is thinking he is being creative as an artist, as a playwright. He doesn't get the playwriting that the android meme is beginning to do, and Marshall's watching that. He's not interested in Wilfred Watson's personal creativity of making a little play. Marshall says, no, Wilfred, you need to join me, and I'm asking you, Katie, to do this, to look at the pattern recognition of the android meme, or to look at the playwriting by the android meme. See? So it's a whole different level. And so in the debate between McLuhan and Watson sort of jinxed, or what is it, a curse by being an inventive, creative poet. He's got a talent, and the society of his time likes that. McLuhan is not a poet in the traditional sense. He's not a musician. He's not creative that way. He's creative on a whole other impersonal level. He's playing with the mm-hmm. media environments themselves. So you have a corporate artist like McLuhan up against a private artist Watson, and that was the key to their debate. So when you read the dialogues, the Place Marie, I think they're called, debates, I might have them somewhere, find and send them to you, you see this two-level dialogue going on. And it's even not a problem for McLuhan. He wants the private person talking and responding to his stuff because that gives him his data for writing the book, gives him examples, content. Wilford Watson didn't know that he was a pawn of McLuhan's, well, we'll call it perceptual apparatus, not just his mind. And now, the media, though, as it develops in the 70s and 80s, in the Android meme, it favors individual kingship or queenship. That's why with Web 2.0, everybody's an emperor. They run their whole scene. Mm-hmm. So the Android meme more and more props up your individual godhood in terms of secular creativity, builds up the, in the world of Mortar, your ability to ignore everything and everybody and create your own scene in many ways with all these shrinking, easily adaptable environments. So the Android meme favors Wilford Watson over McLuhan. They don't want McLuhan pointing out and satirizing the hidden ground of the Android meme. They want someone who has the traditional artistic talents. And so you can see just in any sporting event or any American ballet, all the corporations make sure that their ads are seen around this cultural event. Think of the Kennedy Center, right? They're all hoiking up the individual as a glorious pinnacle of chemical body realization, and it's a big disservice if you don't see the other four levels, the other four bodies that are undermining everybody's success trip that they're doing and whatever they come up with in their particular specialty. It is endlessly undermined. And if you don't know that, you're given no training of perception on that. You'll become bitter. You'll become an alcoholic. You'll become extreme in a lot of activities because you don't know where you are anymore. And nobody, I mean, I used to go to the Guggenheim museums, all the big museums in New York, and they'd have some new artist and put on, and they'd have their show, and many times they would be interviewed after. Or they'd write about it. They'd say, you know, I worked through art school. I came to New York. I made it in the galleries. I got my big retrospective in the Guggenheim Museum or the Museum of Modern Art. And in the end, as I walked home after my big night, I said, where the hell am I? What does it mean? I'll be forgotten tomorrow because another person will be in the museum. See, so the turnover experience impoverishes people's sense of experience. And all kinds of success people, like being an artist, end up being meaningless. William Aaron Thompson went through this, same identity crisis. He eventually dumped everything he was involved with Lindisfarne and said, I'm going to go back and be a poet. So anyways, that's just a little personal dig at William in case he's listening.
talking about art a little bit more, there's one quote in the genre section, too, where it talks about talent rides only in a hackneyed vehicle.
Perfect. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
Talent is the individual specialist. McLuhan writes in Take Today, came out a couple of years later, written around the same time as Cliché Archetype, it comes out a year or two later. Success is failure, and failure as success. If you understand that whatever you think is going to be acknowledged, and the Android meme likes that, if you understand that's a disservice, in the end, not something to be proud of, it's a temporary high, but it's not to be proud of, then you won't know that your talent is a hackneyed vehicle. Hackneyed vehicle. It's a cliche, dead form. Everybody's output, no matter what you do, look at Michelle Obama or even President Obama. They occasionally complain about being a president or first lady. It's boring. It's irritating. It's limiting. It's too specialized. You know, being a president is a hackneyed vehicle. Where everybody else is, you know, you live 300 years, 1,000 years every 12 months, and you're stuck in one role for 4 or 8 years, man, would that be boring. But you, Katie, can do all kinds of things over 8 years because you're not limited to a hackneyed specialist role, especially in a public sense of being a president. So it's very dangerous to enter the public arena and get a stigma or an iconic statement about yourself that you have to, or you feel you have to, keep answering to. We do our darndest here at Iandom to undermine that as much as possible, to get into iconic status and then be stuck with a role.
Mm-hmm. So each of these little treatments that he goes through in this book, I mean, a lot of this seems to be looking at the dialogue in literature.
Yes.
So he, was it's that
a
just
book, a, it's a book about being a book. He's a, he was
sure.
a, considered a great writer, or at least an innovative thinker and writer, and the process of that, of being a writer, and he says, okay, I'm becoming an archetype, but I'm not becoming a Northrop Frye or Carl Jung archetype. I'm becoming another kind of archetype that can come and go endlessly. So he's been retrieved several times since he wrote that book. He's gone back to cliche, you know, new archetype becomes old cliche becomes new archetype. It, that's turned over in his reputation through the 70s while he's still alive and since. So he's the only well-known writer that understood the process of collective creativity that you are subsumed inside of. So it is about books, but it's not, it's a course, it's about, it's a book in relation to a happening of all these mixed medias and different forms of consciousness swirling around it. He's not writing a book to make a message in the book for you. It's a book responding to all the other media around it.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to tell you anything. Trying to show you a pattern of how you would write if you're fully conscious of what I'm talking about. And he said Finnegan's Wake is the book that managed to, how to do it. You write differently than a normal author like Margaret Atwood, just trying to get a good seller and hopefully has a message. And I don't know what she hopes it adjusts or do, whatever. Just get away with it, basically. That's why conventional talent is something that you get away with. Real perception is not exploitable on that level. And that's what I is. We are not exploitable. And, of course, I am the greatest artist and scientist declared by Nelson Sall and others over the years. They didn't know what was coming, but because I didn't stay stuck in any role. So I was ready when the big denouement showed up, Ion, and many of my talented friends and genius friends, they aren't ready for it. They're stuck in their own rearview mirror technologies that they identify with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we grabbed it. Carolyn does medicine the way I'm talking. We were the ones sitting there, the only ones who had reappeared, to grab the new environment, to see it and catch the boomerang.
But I don't think this is just about writing. I mean, this. I think this
no,
is about
that's what I'm saying.
It's living. About, it's about living and how to perceive what's
yeah.
going on around you through. I mean, you can use cliche as a way to break through. Too.
No, but that's what I'm trying to say. That you're not
okay.
understanding me. I'm trying to say that this is how one lives, despite your talents and your success or failures. It doesn't matter if you're, he used to say, a homeless person who can hang around Grand Central Station and have all the services available to everybody. This is back in 1970. You know, radio, newspapers, all there for free. And you're as informed as anybody else. And most people are limited to being informed by what the media offered back then, because that's what people did. They extended their senses and just listened to radio, watched TV, and paid their rent. Well, a homeless person watches TV and engages newspapers or whatever without paying rent. Okay, so how to live is what this is about, yes, but it means that you are made up of more than your chemical body. What is the you that's going to live or how to live? It's the environment that are extensions of yourself are part of your being. How are you going to manage the environments that are around you, that are part of you? So, yes, it is about living, but not in the limited specialist chemical body sense of living. In other words, Martin Marshall said, it's already the planet of the dead. You will finally realize that there's no life in the traditional sense of thousands of years possible by 1960. No possible. You are killed immediately in all the ways that one used to thought they lived. And so Marshall said the question isn't, is there life after death? The question is there life before death? So, you
wow.
see, when you're born, as someone said, with a seatbelt, you know, tied around you when you're one day old, where do you start to have a sense of free experience? Or a liberated experience, whatever it is that people like to have. How do you follow your path to joy? So, yes, that's why McLuhan is the greatest sociologist for understanding society, the greatest psychologist because it does relate to your chemical body's understanding, and he's the greatest scientist because he's dealing with new inventions and he's making new inventions. He's covering it all, and that's replaying what James Joyce did. That's why Marshall said that James Joyce was way greater than Einstein or any of the quantum theorists, because he was actually exploring what the real traditional meaning of science was, wisdom, where wisdom should be applied. So you will find that Ion reflects all this stuff. He comes in speaking from that level. You can hear the humor of Ion. You say, well, I got divorced. I lost my job. I lost my leg. And Ion's going, good, good, good. He's playing down what's happening to your chemical body, because most people are chemical body corpses waiting for a disease to claim the corpse. You know, you've heard some of these phrases. The whole humor is from the level that I'm talking about that McLuhan arrived at.